Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
There's been three girls in my professional life: Snow White, Cinderella, and now Alice. And believe me, they're all different. Snow White was a kind, simple little girl who believed in wishing and waiting for her Prince Charming to come along. On the other hand, Cinderella here was more practical. She believed in dreams all right, but she also believed in doing something about them. When the Prince Charming didn't happen to come along, she went right over to the palace and got him. And now Alice. You know, some people say the mind of a child is more complex and curious than that of an adult. And in this case, I think it's true. To me, Alice is a great deal like children today. Bright, eager, curious about places and people. It's this curiosity that gets her into all those fabulous adventures in Wonderland. I think we've been able to capture that same wondering, curious, childlike quality about Alice. But here, maybe I can show you what I mean.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. We're exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. In our previous episode, we began our journey through the Silver Age with the timeless romance Cinderella. This week, we come to the weird and wonderful Alice in Wonderland. Each episode on Ink and Paint, I'm joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Hale from the University of New England and Anna Mick from the University of Warsaw. Dr. Hale is an associate professor in UNE's Faculty of Humanities, Arts, Social Sciences and Education with a focus on children's literature and media, fantasy literature and 19th century literature. She is currently writing a guide to the field of children's literature inspired by classical mythology. Anna has a master's in Polish philosophy and is a PhD candidate in the Faculty of Artes Liberales. Her research focuses include the study of monstrosity, human-animal studies, minority discourses, and children's literature. Together, they are part of the international research project Our Mythical Childhood, the reception of classical antiquity in children and young adults' culture in response to regional and global challenges. Elizabeth and Anna, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Individually, both of your focuses are in your research are around children's literature and children's culture. What led you both to settling on these areas of investigation?
I've always loved reading, and I've always loved reading children's books. And I've always liked stories that have beginnings, middles and ends. And I also like stories with pictures. And when I was a student at I grew up in New Zealand, so I studied at the University of Otago in Dunedin, and when I was a student I did degrees in English and Latin, and I got really interested in how English literature and Latin literature intertwine, and then I went off and did a PhD in Boston in America at a place called Brandeis University, which is a small liberal arts college with very interesting, intense focus on things. And I went off to be a 19th century scholar for some reason. I thought that was going to be the thing I wanted to do. And I think because of liking long stories and stories with like lots of things happening in them, and also literature with lots of character and how does one become the person one is? And the Victorians, I think, were really fascinated by that. That's what I did. But when I got there, one of my new classmates said, come to a book sale. So we went to a basement book sale on campus, and she showed me a book by a writer called Charlotte Mary Young, who was one of the great 19th century children's writers. And she said, I'm going to write on that. And I was like, oh, can you do scholarship on children's literature? Because I had no idea. She said, oh, yes. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I carried on doing grown-up literature for the most part, and I was doing my PhD on classical scholars in 19th century fiction, which was bringing together those Latin and English literature ideas, because I wondered why all the classical scholars in Victorian fiction were such horrible people. And somewhere along the line, I was sort of looking for more to write about, and I wrote to this discussion list, and people said, well, what about the children's books? Because you see a lot of teachers and children's books. And so I managed to bring the two together. And from that, I just carried on. And when I finished my PhD, I got together with a New Zealand buddy. We went to a conference together, and we actually, the only papers we went to were the ones we gave. And we spent most of our time in cafes, we're saying, what did we want to do? And we thought we'd like to write about the books that we liked when we were kids. We wrote a book on Margaret Mahe, who's one of New Zealand's greatest children's writers. Fabulous woman, so incredibly inventive and creative and brilliant, and kind of in a really bonkers way, and quite unusual for New Zealand writing, actually, which is often quite controlled. It sort of just went from there. You know, sometimes people say to me, oh, when you grow up, are you going to write grown-up books? And I was like, no, I don't think I am, because I think it's an aesthetic choice. And I was interviewing an Australian writer called Ursula Dubazarski, who is an absolutely wonderful writer. And I said to her, why do you write children's books? And she said, it's an aesthetic choice. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what it is for me too. There's something about the focus and the way, and the presentation and style that I just really like.
How about for you, Anna? How did you come to being interested and then focusing your research on children's culture and children's literature?
My experience, in a way, is quite similar to Elizabeth's, because I started my studies at Polish philology, and I felt quite serious because, you know, you start a new chapter of your life and you become a grown-up. And I never thought you can actually study children's literature because it's so absurd, because it's for children, right? So I've started to go to this wonderful class of a friend of mine, and she was talking a lot about fairy tales and classic children's literature, among those Alice. And I became just fascinated. I felt just like I found my place in this serious, serious world. And I continue my education at this faculty, and I decided to do my PhD on Disney and how Disney influenced Polish children's literature in the 30s, 40s, because Polish authors were writing children's books based on Disney's ideas, but they shifted a lot of things. They changed a lot of things in their books. So I wanted to compare Disney American vision of children's world and how it transfers to Polish children's literature. But then the Our Mythical Childhood project came up. And thank God, because it's a fascinating experience. Our Mythical Childhood basically researched the reception of classical myths in children's culture in general. Very, very broad, a broad approach. And in this project, we do various things, so I'm just now anxious to name them all. But, for example, my task as an assistant in this project, led by Professor Katarzyna Marciniak from the Faculty of Artes Liberales, is to write a PhD. And it's about the excluded monsters that we find in children's culture that represent any kind of social excluded minorities, and that's my part of the job. But in general, we do various research. One of the biggest branch of this project is to create the online database, now over 1,000 I think entries on works, a lot of different kinds, books, movies, TV series, toys, myths from Cameroon, for example. And these entries are basically the summaries and analysis of these works.
And what are some of the recurring themes that you're finding in the project that kind of linking through children's and young adult culture and literature and mythology? Is there any kind of running threads through those stories and through those traditions?
I'm not sure. I discovered that you can actually research this in so many aspects. So I'm particularly focused on gender, for example, how mythical creatures from classical mythology reappearing in children's literature and culture somehow break the gender roles or gender stereotypes. For example, Medusa, being a villain in most of the stories, become a friend of many, many of the characters in children's culture. For example, this shifting of the monster, I think, is the basic thing that I observe. But I don't know about how do you see that, Liz?
There's so many stories for kids are influenced by classical mythology. I mean, broadly speaking, there are different types. So there are sort of straight retellings, like collections, and you see those in bookshops all over the place. You know, My First Greek Reader, My First Greek Myths, My First 12 Olympians, which kind of retell the myths in a kind of often a straightforward way. And then there are a sort of adaptations, and they can do things like retell a classical myth from the perspective, say, of the their child. And so they're sort of retelling them as if in modern ways, I guess. And so you get they can range from very simple picture books right up to quite intense, long adolescent novels. And then you also get things like the gods appearing in our world. So there's all sorts of very funny, I have to say, books. I'm really fond of this particular genre of gods appearing. So there's a wonderful series called Gods Behaving Badly, where the gods are living in a rundown flat somewhere in North London, and nobody believes in them anymore, so they have to get jobs. So it's very rude, that one. It's for older, much older, really probably for grown-ups. But so there's those sorts of things. So they're sort of fantasy tropes. And then there's other ones where the mythological story is played out in the life of usually teenagers. So there's a kind of, and this I think connects a lot with what Anya's working on, the kind of trajectory for teenage literature is often about who am I in the world and how am I going to cope with this crazy life. And connecting with the mythological stories is quite a deep way of reflecting on those ideas. So that can be about all kinds of identity and power and talent and empowerment and agency and family. Because a lot of the myths are about family problems, if you think about it. You know, there are a lot of, and the hero stories and all those kinds of things. And that's sort of the tip of the iceberg. But, yeah, it's quite a big iceberg.
To segue from talking about kind of like, you know, ancient mythology and ancient storytelling to, you know, modern storytelling, into talking about Disney, do you remember what the first Disney animated classic was that you saw?
Yeah, The Lion King was the first one. And I've always enjoyed my mother saying with tears in her eyes how I was standing up in the cinema and crying when Mufasa died. I think this is the generational story of my people, that people from born in the 90s all saw Lion King or Aladdin in the movie theater, and they cried a lot.
How old would you have been when you saw it?
Four or three.
Oh my god. That's a big film to take a 3 or 4 year old to. Like, that's huge.
It shaped me well. Yes. But I love it to this day. I think it's one of my favorites.
I'm not sure. And I grew up in New Zealand in the 1970s. So we're going back a while. And we didn't have a TV until I was about 8, I think. But I remember being taken to see Snow White, which must have been on a re-release. I was obviously a literary critic from a very young age, because I was furious because in the Grimm's fairy tale I'd read, there were 3 attempts on Snow White's life. I think the witch has 3 goes, and there was only 1 go in the Disney version for obvious reasons. But I was absolutely outraged. And I also remember being taken to see The Song of the South.
Oh, wow.
That was with my father. I was a bit older then, but for some reason that really hit hard for me, and I had to be taken home screaming because I was so upset by whatever happened in that film. I think that's when a little boy gets tossed by a bull or something.
Yeah, I saw it when I was a kid as well, and I do have a vague memory of something like that.
And that really, really did a number on me. But, you know, most of my Disney memories are quite happy, and when we were a bit older, my parents are British, so we would go back to Britain and there would be stopovers in Singapore or LA, and we went through LA and went to Disneyland, and that was quite fascinating. And I remember I'm older than my brother and sister, who were just ecstatic, but I was kind of puzzled by the whole place because I knew there were people inside the outfits, and they didn't. And this kind of puzzled me. So yeah, it's kind of a interesting thing. And then I had a great friend at uni who we both liked animation, so whenever Disney was on, we'd go and see one.
When Liz started to talk about Snow White, I remembered that the Snow White actually was shaped on basis of the goddess of spring.
Yes.
So I think this is a very nice mythological coincidence that mythology was very much involved in Disney's productions, right? Even though we don't see it at first glance, because when we see Snow White, we think, oh, Grimm's fairy tale and so on, we should compare it to that. But we also have to keep in mind that Persephone was the first princess in Disney World, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, Hamilton Lusk used the Silly Symphony of the Goddess of Spring, where he animated Persephone as a test to see whether they could animate Snow White, because at that point they weren't sure whether they could animate female characters yet. I think that's the thing that's really exciting about Disney, is as much as we look at them on a kind of surface level of being, you know, pieces of popular entertainment, the more you dig into them, the storytelling roots in those films, particularly the films in Walt Disney's lifetime, have such deep kind of primal cultural humanist roots to them. They're so dense and deep. It's strange to think that a work of art we now regard as a classic was ever considered otherwise, by the public or by the artists themselves. We see everything that makes the work distinct, important, timeless, and thrilling, and assume that to have always been the case. It is disorienting to realise that when it was first brought into the world, it was in fact considered the opposite. Cinderella was seen as an ecstatic return to form for Walt Disney Productions. Critics loved it and the public fully embraced it, making the film their first genuine box office hit in over a decade. Walt Disney and his artists may have been able to see all of the shortcuts, but at least the film actually worked. It was economical, moving, and wildly entertaining. Cinderella had been relatively straightforward to adapt, a classic fairy tale with familiar beats and deep storytelling roots. Their next film was a very different beast, an ambitious adaptation of a literary monolith that had seemed perfectly suited to animation, but had proven incredibly difficult to adapt. Much like the story itself, the making of the film was a strange and maddening journey, one to find what Walt and the artist were so desperately looking for, an answer to an impossible riddle. How on earth do you make a film of Alice in Wonderland? Alice is bored of the history lesson her sister is delivering to her by the riverbank when she spots a white rabbit, dressed in a waistcoat and in a tither about being late. She follows it down a rabbit hole and finds herself in a strange place where little makes sense, where she changes size constantly and which is populated by a collection of eccentric and disagreeable characters, all insistent on teaching her lessons she has no interest or need for. Determined to find the white rabbit, she ends up in the court of the Queen of Hearts, where her frustrations and their collective antics reach breaking point, and she wakes up on the riverbank, having had the strangest dream. On July 4th, 1862, Oxford mathematician, the Reverend Charles Ludwig Dodgson, was taking a boat ride on the Thames in Oxfordshire with his friend, the Reverend Robertson Duckworth, and three of the young daughters of Oxford scholar Henry Liddell, Lorena, Alice, and Edith. The girls complained of being bored, so Dodgson began to make up stories to entertain them, set in a fantastical place that mirrored England, and in particular Oxford, at the time, and featuring 10-year-old Alice as the hero, who he had a special affection for. They were enraptured over the 5-mile journey, and at the end, Alice asked Dodgson to write the stories down for her. 3 years later, in 1865, under the pseudonym Lewis Carroll, Dodgson published the stories as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which, along with its sequel, Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There, published in 1871, would become the most popular and important work ever written for children. As well as Carroll's playful and witty text, which bucked the trend of Victorian children's literature by refusing to moralise or talk down to its child readers, the books were accompanied by illustrations from acclaimed political cartoonist John Tenniel, which have become as iconic as the books themselves. The influence of the Alice books on world culture, from literature to art to psychology, is practically impossible to comprehend. And it has become one of those rare texts that reaches across generations, genders, cultures, and languages. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is, quite simply, one of the most beloved and influential works of literature ever written. Walt Disney's long and tempestuous relationship with the Alice books began when he read them as a schoolboy. Alice was also a popular subject in early cinema, and it's very likely that he would have seen one of those early film versions. In 1923, after the failure of the Laugh-O-Gram shorts, he pitched an idea loosely based on the Alice books that riffed on the Fleischer Brothers' popular Out of the Inkwell series, where a live-action Alice falls down a rabbit hole and ends up in cartoon land. After frantically shopping around the first completed short, Alice's Wonderland, he made a distribution and production deal with Winkler Pictures, beginning his fateful working relationship with Charles Mintz. A decade later, when Walt and Roy Disney began early plans for a feature-length animated film, Alice in Wonderland was one of the first properties they considered. What followed would be a 20-year journey to the screen, where the project would pass through many hands and go through many iterations. It was an idea that Walt simply couldn't shake, either because he felt an affection for the story, because he'd been told it would make a great film, or because by the time he realised the project was in serious trouble, it was simply too late to pull the plug. There was also the enormous pressure that came with taking on such an adaptation. The other Disney features were based on thinly constructed fairy tales and short stories that they could expand on, or relatively contemporary novels they could bend to their needs. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was an established literary giant, one beloved by millions of all ages. Their adaptation had to be respectful to the original text. The journey of Alice in Wonderland to the screen would be a long and intensely frustrating one, not only for Walt Disney, but for the artists themselves involved in solving its endless conundrums. Before we get to talking about the film itself, I wanted to kind of ask for both of you, having with your background in the studies in children's literature, where does Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through Looking Glass sit within the wider scope of children's literature? How important or influential are they?
Oh, they're very, very important, especially in 19th century children's literature. It's seen as a kind of watershed text in English children's literature anyway, which is, and it's because it's the first major novel written in which the child's sort of agency, individual agency, is really important. So, and it's not a moral text. It's an anti-moral text. It really did change, I think, a lot of people's ideas of what children's literature could do and be. And, you know, it's so many things as well. It's a puzzle and a riddle, and it's deeply philosophical, and there are many, many ways and layers to it. So, yeah, it is kind of an urtext in many ways.
This is a real worldwide phenomenon, and I can only speak, maybe mainly speak from Polish perspective, but I think we have like over 20 translations of Alice in Wonderland, so it has a very long tradition of translation that shows how almost instantly important this book was and still is to this day. So it's like one of the real classic.
Why do you think those books have had such an enormous wider popular cultural impact? I mean, these are, you know, not many other works of children's literature from the Victorian period have stuck around in the way that the Alice books have. Why do you think it is that people are drawn to them and drawn to her?
For me, I think it comes back to this idea of the child's agency, and that, well, I mean, you, probably everybody knows the story about how the book had a genesis in Lewis Carroll going out on a picnic on a riverboat with the children of Dean Liddell, who was actually a great classical scholar and did the one of the big lexicons. And he told the story to amuse Alice and her sisters. And then he went home and finished it off. And so it's a story told to amuse a child. And Lewis Carroll came from a background of playing around with ideas and language, and he and his father, I think his father was very into wordplay as well as he was. So it's got that playful quality, and I think that's actually one part of the answer, is that it's funny and playful and silly, and you're allowed to be silly when you read it and people are nonsensical.
Which is a fact that culturally people don't remember about that book. I mean, that's the thing that I always find when, because I read it once a year, basically. And the one, whenever I mention that, people are like, why? I'm like, because it's really funny. It's an incredibly entertaining, funny, silly, whimsical book.
Yeah. So that's one part. And then I think the other part is that Alice is not funny. She's actually very serious. And so it's actually, this is what I mean about, it's a book that takes a child seriously. And they're not just there to be educated and out of being a child. They're actually there to be respected for the person they are at the moment of the story. But it's unapologetic in respecting the child as a kind of character who can work her way through a difficult situation. Even though it is funny and strange, it's also quite a frightening book.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think the other thing that we have to point out is that the legend around this book is quite huge. And everyone has this image in their heads that, oh, Dutchman went to this boat ride and it was a golden afternoon and it was so magical. And even though not all of us might even read this book, everyone has this idea of Alice based on popular culture that reproduced this image of Alice. So we can find her everywhere. We can find her in the advertisement, I think. Advertisement loves Alice.
I think the illustrations have something to do with that too, don't they? Lewis Carroll himself illustrated the original version, which you can see online at the British Museum's, not British Museum, British Libraries. The British Library has a web image of the entire manuscript, which you can look through, and that you see Carroll's original illustrations. But then when the book was published, they had the illustrations of John Tenniel, who's a great 19th century illustrator.
And they're quite monolithic in a way, the stance that the illustration. I mean, in the making of this film, one of the things that caused so many years of trouble for the artists working in the film was the fact that Disney was like, no, it has to look like Tenniel. Even though it's kind of impossible to imagine, like, the beautiful thing about Tenniel's drawings is you don't imagine what's on the outside of the frame of those drawings. They are complete within themselves. They're beautiful little each one's a beautiful little masterpiece. In fact, when they had the Wonderland exhibition here in Melbourne at ACME, which is the exhibition on the history of Alice in film and media, one of the things I didn't expect was that they would have a whole section about the writing of the book, and they had Tenniel's sketches. So not the final artwork, but he's like these tiny little sketches that he made in preparation for the final artworks. And they're each image is just so extraordinary. It kind of blazes into your mind, which I guess is kind of the beauty of a great work of illustration for the written word, of two things that are in complete symbiosis with one another.
Yeah, and I think that must have something to do with it too. And there's that wonderful bit which Disney keeps, which is what is the use of a book without pictures in it? And I think that's got something to do with it too. There's a very interesting book which talks about some of the precursors to Alice, about sort of children's and grown-ups' nonsense stories, and there actually is a tradition of these kind of journeys to other nonsense places. But I think Carroll sort of synthesized it really well with Alice.
Yeah, and I think it made it very universal, because this is also interesting, because we also very often forget that this book was written by an adult man. And one of the things that might connect both Carroll and Disney is the fact that they maybe wanted to come back to childhood, which seemed in their imagination to be a wonderful land and full of these colorful elements and adventures and other wonderful things. But actually, it ended up being a horrible experience, as it was for Alice. This contradictions between the imagination, the idea of childhood and how the childhood actually was is quite universal thing, right?
That's a great way to bounce into asking about the film. Do you remember the first time that each of you saw this film version of Alice, the Disney version?
It was not part of my Disney education, unfortunately. So, or not education, but growing up with. So I grew up with the 90s productions, like Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, and so on. But Alice was a little bit older, and it's not as I remember it, watching it as a child, it was not as warm, attractive, if I might say. So I wasn't very drawn to it, as I was to other films.
I'm pretty sure I watched it with my family when we did get a TV and maybe a VCR or something, because I have a memory of watching with them, but it's a very dim memory.
And what did you make of revisiting it for this chat? What did you make of the film now? First of all, as just an audience member, but you know, then also taking into account your studies into children's literature and literature and culture.
Well, I thought that, because I said to Anna on email yesterday, I'm going to go and watch Alice now and relax, and it's not a relaxing film at all. And I was sort of trying to keep an eye out for what had he kept and what have they done differently, and they've woven some of the bits from The Looking Glass in, like the Jabberwocky echoes and things like that. It struck me that they kept the sort of anarchic and frightening spirit of things very well, and the surrealism and the way that there's not really a single straight line in Wonderland. Nothing stands straight. Everything's slightly crooked and leaning. And I think that's why it's so not relaxing to watch. And I thought that, well, why was it so frightening? Well, there were a few things for me. There was a sort of image of devouring, and there was a lot of eat or be eaten stuff going on in there. I think that's in the book as well, and it's, you know, a lot of things are going on in the 19th century, like kind of the origin of species is coming out and all those sort of really influential ideas about evolution and the world. So you can see that going on. There seems to be a big anxiety about women going through this film as well. It seemed to be a very womb-like experience, but not a nice womb. Alice goes down a tunnel into this other world, and she has to fight her way through kind of non-linear space, and then she encounters the Queen of Hearts. So things like that. I was sort of surprised that the Duchess wasn't there.
I think they tried for a long time to work out how to incorporate the Duchess, but it was also one of those things where I think the trickiest thing for any Alice adaptation is not what you include but what you don't, because you kind of have it's a feast of riches really to choose from in terms of what you keep. Particularly if you're choosing to focus on both books and not just the first book like this film does.
I don't know if you saw the Australian Ballet's Alice in Wonderland.
I didn't. I really wanted to, but I didn't get to see it, no.
They did the Duchess, and it was I went with some friends and quite a lot of children, and we were all quite alarmed by the Duchess scene, because it's very like, it was like Sweeney Todd a bit, and this idea of butchery and the baby turning into the pig, but there was this huge sort of winged, you know, those armchairs where you lean back and they've, but it was like a pig. It had pig trotters for its legs, if I'm remembering right. And so all the grown-ups were just like, oh, and sort of racing over at intermission to see if the kids were okay, but the kids all thought it was hilarious. There's something in that too about that going back, is that things that you laugh at when you're a child, when you look at when you're an adult, you just go, wow, that's freaky. But as a child, you might actually just laugh.
And how did you find it, Anna, returning to it as an adult, and particularly through the lens of your studies?
I think you can both easily relate to the problem that we all have as scholars and researchers. It's hard to turn off this analytic switch in your mind. So if you're watching it with special approach, you just think, oh, okay, I'm going to now compare the book with the movie and then do something with it. But on emotional level, I think it can be quite therapeutic, because we can see Alice behaving like a grown woman, immersing in the world of her unconsciousness. Because we have quite literal suggestion that this is Alice's dream, because she wakes up and so on. And so I think this is the main thing that I've taken from the animation. But then again, I think from the very beginning, I started to analyze it. And I came back to the first chapter of Carol's book. And I wanted to check what intrigued Alice at the very beginning, which I'm sure we're going to come back to that maybe. But what Alice is saying in Rabbit's behavior is so weird. It's not that he talks, because to my experience, rabbits do not really talk very often. But it's the watch.
Yeah, she sees the waistcoat. She just kind of like, oh yeah, it's got a waistcoat on. And it isn't until it pulls out the watch and looks at it. And even in the film, you have them and she's like, oh, there's a rabbit in the waistcoat. Oh my God, and it's got a watch. And that's what grabs her attention.
Instantly, I think, oh, now she follows this rabbit. And in pop culture, we always think that Alice follows this rabbit, but actually she follows time. And then my brain goes on and I think it's very, very intellectual, not motivating, but triggering, let's just say. It triggers analysis very, very, very fast.
Because she's such an inquisitive character. I mean, the thing that, you know, the first question she asks, she sees in the film, she sees the white rabbit. She sees that it has a watch. Her first question after realizing it has a watch is, why does it have a watch? Why does it think it's late? What is it late for? He must be late for a party. I should follow him. I mean, it's rude to turn up if you're not invited, but curiosity often leads to trouble. But who knows? You know, it might be fun. And that's how she falls down the rabbit hole. It's kind of like this. She starts, particularly the way that she's presented in the Disney film, which does preserve Carol's original intent with Alice of a character who's just following her instincts and her thoughts as they present themselves.
It's funny that she doesn't question her reality, but the reality questions her, true to both book and animation.
Something seems to be troubling you. Won't you tell us all about it?
Start at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. And when you come to the end, stop.
The first plans to adapt Alice into a feature film date back to the early 1930s. In 1933, screen legend Murray Pickford desperately wanted to play Alice and approached Walt with the idea of a film combining live action and animation. Walt was unsure though, possibly because the idea had originated from Pickford and wasn't entirely his, and they tentatively discussed the project until Paramount announced their own live action star-studded adaptation for release that year. In the burst of excitement after the success of Snow White, the idea of adapting Alice was revived, and through the story research department, the rights to John Tenniel's illustrations were secured. In 1938, Walt registered the title Alice in Wonderland, and set storyman Al Perkins to begin working out how to adapt the novel. The problem Perkins needed to solve was the story's episodic structure. The only central narrative arc was that of Alice wandering through the woods, and this wasn't enough to hang a film on. They needed to find something to hold the structure together and to make Alice a sympathetic character. Around the same time, British-born art director David Hall was approached by Disney artist and talent recruiter Phil Dyke to join the studio. Hall was the first artist to work on Alice, and in his short time at Disney, he produced a prolific amount of material. Hall joined the studio in March 1939, but surreptitiously began work on Alice. Legend has it that either an ambitious Disney executive or director David Hand secretly set up Hall in an office just off the Hyperion lot, where he began working on conceptualizing and storyboarding Alice based on Perkins' script. On top of the mountain of concept art Hall produced, he had also storyboarded the entire film, which was presented to Walt in a Leica reel, accompanied by recorded dialogue and songs by Frank Churchill. Both Walt and the other Disney artists were baffled by Hall's work. He had strayed too far from Tenniel's style for Walt's liking, and Hall's work was rich, intricate, and full of detail. Many of the artists at the time described it as overwhelming and grotesque, and Walt rejected both Hall's artwork and Perkins' script as being too dark, ordering the project to start again from scratch. During his 15 months at the studio, David Hall produced over 400 individual pieces for Alice in Wonderland, as well as Dumbo, Peter Pan, and the Reluctant Dragon, and after being rediscovered many decades later, is now considered some of the most extraordinary concept artwork in the Disney archives. Work continued on trying to crack the story, but it was already becoming clear that Alice was not going to be easy. The box office failures in the early 40s and the start of the Second World War ground development to a halt, but despite being shelved around 1940, they hadn't completely given up on Alice, and during the war, it was still sitting in the back of Walt's mind. After the war in 1945, Walt was tentatively able to restart a number of the projects that had been shelved the few years earlier, one of which was Alice. He returned to the idea of combining live action and animation, considering first Ginger Rogers and later Margaret O'Brien for the role. At the same time, he approached British novelist Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, to write the adaptation. Huxley's script strayed even further from Carroll's novel than the treatment by Al Perkins and David Hall, featuring Lewis Carroll and Alice Liddell themselves as characters, and a series of eccentric Victorian figures that mirrored characters in Wonderland. Once again, Walt was frustrated by how much the story had departed from the original, and Huxley didn't last long at the studio, often being talked over by Walt in story meetings. No one had solved the episodic structure, though Perkins had proposed using the Cheshire Cat as a guide for Alice, an idea that does partly make it into the final film. Alice also wasn't much of a character. She was more of a cipher, entirely responsive and often passive compared to the overbearing characters she meets. There was also the issue of how to translate the wit in Carroll's writing to the screen in a way that was both respectful and visual. The artist tried responding to the provocations in the novel by coming up with new and original ideas, but at every turn, Walt demanded they return to the source, to let the humour come out of the characters and situations that were already there. This was completely unlike their approach to Pinocchio or Bambi, where the source material had been used as a starting point. With Alice, Walt insisted that they use the source material as a roadmap, but the more they broke the story apart, the clearer it became that this roadmap might be leading to nowhere. A breakthrough finally came, as with so many projects from this period, thanks to Mary Blair. She submitted a number of concept artworks, and Walt immediately fell in love with them. They were once again removed from Tennille's illustrations, but they helped Walt conceive a new look for the film, one with bold colours and a strong graphic design. He now wanted the film to focus much more on the comedy, the rhythm, and the whimsy of the book. They still hadn't solved the story problems, but at least they could finally start conceptualising what the film might look like. In 1946, after 13 years of development, production on Alice in Wonderland officially began. Well, my first question in talking about the film itself is, what kind of Alice are we presented with in this film adaptation? And how does that differ or correlate with the Alice that we know from Carroll's work?
Well, in both, in book and in animation, I always think of her as a grown woman. I'm not sure why. Because I think it's combined with British Victorian culture at the time and how the Victorians wanted to see the child as a small grown-up, right? And I think she fights it along the way.
It's also the fact that, I mean, the advantage that they have with this being the first animated, I think the first animated Alice, is that in every other version you can't cast a seven-year-old. A seven-year-old, within, you know, our understanding of what we think can happen in a film, a seven-year-old can't do what we assume can't do what Alice has to do in the story. And so in every other version, she is older. We're never presented with an Alice who's actually seven. We're more presented with an Alice that's 15. And the difference between a seven-year-old girl and a 15-year-old girl is enormous, and particularly when you put her in the male-dominated landscape of a place like Wonderland. The advantage that the Disney film has is, as much as, you know, Alice is still not quite seven, she's definitely not a teenager. She sits the closest of any of the versions I can think of, closest to the actual age that Carroll set her at.
I mean, seven is a kind of magic age for childhood, because it's when the child has sort of left infancy and left toddlerhood, and they're kind of beginning to be socialized and sort of aping adult behaviors and norms and those kind of things. And I always find Alice so fascinating, because she's so into things like tea parties and I think what's so great is that Carroll captures the domestic world of a Victorian girl. So he thinks really carefully about what does she know? And there's sort of strange political things like the caucus race and the court, which, as I know as a child myself, I kind of was like, what on earth? Yeah, but in the Disney, yeah, she's sort of always moving. I think that was the thing that really struck me, is that she never really, there's that one bit where she really stops and sits down and she sings a song. But there's a kind of, it's constantly moving, I think, and that's what my dominant feeling about this film was watching it yesterday. It was like, it's just constantly moving. There's nowhere to rest. And I think that's why I found it less relaxing than I had expected.
And I think one of the things that it's worth pointing out is that at the beginning she sings the song about her wishes and her wonderland. And I think this is a very important moment, because usually in Disney animation, when the main character sings, it sings about her dreams or his dreams and how their dreams will maybe come true. And it actually comes true, because Alice's dreams of world only with pictures, with no words. And I think this is very important, that the words mislead her constantly in Wonderland. The names are confusing and she doesn't get it. She, just as in the book, she missed up the poem that she's about to recite. She doesn't remember it. So yeah, I think this is also a very, very well-executed part of Disney animation.
It struck me watching it today, and I mean, I've watched this film probably more than any other film I've ever seen. And it's the lovely thing watching it today was still there are more things in it that I keep discovering. But one of the things that I really loved watching it this afternoon is that exact thing of like the way words are used within the structure of the world of Wonderland. Because one of the things that's so wonderful about Carol's text is how playful it is with wordplay and puns. And even the visual language of this film is still doing that. When she's in the garden of flowers, and you know they're singing about On a Golden Afternoon, and every single flower is a pun, but it's not a pun of any of made up words. It's just them taking an idea of like, this is a word in the English language. This is a word to do with horticulture and flowers. How can we turn this into a visual joke, but also allow it to be part of the wider fabric of the world? It's one of the really nice things about this film is that the world of Wonderland feels like it's defined. You don't know what the rules of it are, but it feels like an actual thing where things are happening, things are living, things are moving and evolving. It doesn't feel like just a bunch of weird objects or weird characters. It feels like it has a kind of ecology, whether that ecology be a real thing or the ecology of Alice's mind responding to, I'd rather live in a world with all pictures and no words.
One of the things that struck me too was, I mean, when somebody adapts a novel to a visual medium, one of the things that gets lost is the narrative voice. So, and in this novel, you're sort of in Alice's mind as you read. So the book's constantly telling you what Alice thought and what she said, but particularly what she thought. The film's got to capture that. So I think that's where the constant movement and the crooked lines and all the other stuff is going on. But a lot of the wordplay, her answering back is lost in the film. I think that's fine. I don't have that. It's not a problem. But the book has Alice speaking back and trying to reason with the Wonderland inhabitants.
Her frustration is very palpable in the book. You can tell by the end of it, she's like, I've had enough of this bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's a kind of an interesting difference, I think.
It's one of the real challenges, I guess, with adapting it, because, I mean, because Alice is so, I mean, the book moves like a freight train. It doesn't take a breath in a magnificent, rollicking, thrilling way. But because so much of that is conversation, and the rhythm and the thrill of it is in the wordplay and the jokes and the kind of linguistical gymnastics that are happening within the novel. But when you translate that to screen, it becomes ponderous. Like, there are so many versions of Alice that I can think of on film. Like, one of my big arguments is there should never be a film version of Alice that goes for longer than an hour and a half. It's just illogical for it to, because otherwise it becomes boring. It's a bunch of people sitting around talking. What this film does is, yes, it kind of strips out a lot of not dead wood, because there's not a single piece of dead wood in the novel, but kind of strips it back to its bare minimum in order to retain the feeling of reading the novel, of what the experience is of, as you're reading the book.
Well, Carroll obviously worked with the words, Disney with the picture, and I think he'd done it really well. Well, I think the scene from the Tolgi wood is one of the most exquisite scenes in this movie. It's because it's actually real. It seemed real to me. And if we come back to this idea of Alice building a world of her own and with her own pictures, it's interesting how in this scene she feels completely lost and alone. And all the creatures that sits around her cries with her, but they also blend into the background.
It's almost like the drawings disintegrate. They go from full painted cells to like pencil tests to nothing.
Absolutely. And if we identify Wonderland as Alice's subconscious, we might say that she's losing herself and her eye in this story. So I think it's a very important moment for her, that all these crazy things happening around her is now lost. But then she moves to the Duchess, not the Duchess, but the Queen. And I think, yeah.
Well, it's the point in the story where she kind of loses, because another beautiful thing about Alice as a book, and also the way it's been translated to this film, is the fact that Alice's motivation as a character is very straightforward. In the book, I have to get to the garden. In the film, I have to follow the White Rabbit. That moment in the Tolgi Wood in the film has such an emotional potency, because you can tell that she's lost her motivation. She's gone to the point with the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. This is the stupidest tea party I've ever been to. Of course she's going to walk out. It makes no sense. They're not listening to her. They don't have time for her. And then that moment in the Tolgi Wood is her kind of that lost moment of going, I don't know what my purpose is anymore. I don't know where I'm supposed to go with this anymore. And there's nobody. The expectation, of course, is that adults are supposed to be there to guide a child and to give them guidance about what it is they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to understand the world and the lens they're supposed to look through. She's stuck in a place where nobody is willing to give her the time of day for that.
Exactly, but the adult characters in this world, so the rabbit, flowers, I don't know, the bird that was sitting on her head and called her a serpent, they rejected her in every single way. Flowers call her weeds, right? The rabbit calls her a monster when she grows into his house. And she feels rejected by all the adult characters in this world. And she feels alone also because of that. So maybe both book and animation actually present that there is a sort of disconnection between the adult world and the child's world.
If I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't. And contrariwise, what it is, it wouldn't be. And what it wouldn't be, it would. You see?
Over the course of our episodes on the Silver Age of Disney animation, we're taking a look at each of the 9 old men, the core team of animators that defined the classic Disney style. In this episode, we're looking at the mad genius of Ward Kimball.
Who do you work for, Ward?
Walt Disney.
You work for Disney? Oh, I thought your face was familiar. Are you the duck or the mouse?
No, I'm an animator and director out there.
Kimball was born on March 4th, 1914 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and from an early age began exploring what would become two of his greatest passions, drawing and steam trains, which were among the first things he drew. After graduating, he enrolled in the Santa Barbara School of Art in the hopes of becoming a magazine illustrator. But when he saw Three Little Pigs, his interest shifted towards animation. His instructor convinced him to apply for a position at Walt Disney Productions, and in April 1934, the 20-year-old Kimball was hired as an in-betweener, soon after being promoted to assistant animator for Hamilton Lusk. Within 2 years, he had been promoted to animator, and apart from work on the Silly Symphonies, had fully animated the soup-eating scene that was cut from Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. For Pinocchio, he was promoted once again to supervising animator, and given the task of designing and animating Jiminy Cricket, a task Kimball found frustrating despite its success. He would go on to animate the Crows in Dumbo, an actor supervising animator on Fantasia and The Reluctant Dragon, but it was on The Three Caballeros that Kimball developed a style that made him singular amongst his peers. His work on the La Piñata sequence in Caballero is pure insanity, breaking many of the conventions that had dictated the Disney style, and when directing supervisor Clyde Geronimi saw it, he was sure Walt would reject it. Instead, Walt loved Kimball's work, which Kimball later called the proudest of his career.
One of the first criticisms when the director saw the pencil test is, well, the duck goes out to the right and he comes in on the left. And the rooster goes out at the top and he comes in from the bottom. You can't do that. It's not logical. You have to have these tie-ups. You have to make sense. And I said, look, who cares? Guy runs out on the left, comes in on the right. I mean, That gives it its flavor, its craziness.
This madcap texture became the defining quality of Kimball's animation style and would dictate the kind of work he would be assigned. There were further triumphs with his work in the package films and with the mice and Lucifer the Cat in Cinderella, but Alice in Wonderland would see Kimball reaching his zenith during the Silver Age. The surreal and frantic rhythm of the film, a perfect match for him. He would animate Tweedledum and Tweedledee, The Walrus and the Carpenter, and The Cheshire Cat, but his triumph is the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, one of the greatest sequences in any Disney film. Following Alice, Kimball became a prolific director of short subjects, winning Oscars for Toot, Whistle, Plunk and Boom, and It's Tough to Be a Bird. When the studio transitioned to television in the 1950s, he directed a number of hour-long specials on the space race, and continued to direct and produce work for television until he left the studio. Kimball also had a close relationship with Walt, and shared with him his obsession with model trains and locomotives. He was also an accomplished jazz trombonist, and formed the Dixieland band Firehouse 5 Plus 2. By the time Kimball left the studio in 1973, he had left an indelible mark on Disney animation. No one else could animate like Kimball, who combined remarkable draftsmanship with his witty, irreverent sense of humour. One could credit Kimball with helping to usher Disney animation away from the romantic style of Pinocchio and Bambi to one more representational and energetic, where the infinite possibilities of animation could be fully embraced. His work in The Three Caballeros and Alice in Wonderland stand as testaments to his remarkable imagination. He passed away at the age of 88 on July 8, 2002. There's such a struggle in the book around gender and class. And that's one of the most magnificent features of the kind of subtext in the books, particularly the first one. How is that subtext around gender and class translated over into the Disney film? Or has it translated over into the Disney film?
I think it is. I think a lot of the Wonderland characters are not posh. They've got, you know, they've got northern accents or Cockney accents or that kind of thing, and they're sort of servants of the Queen, a lot of them. I was just thinking as you were talking, it's not necessarily not about gender, but one of the things that happens when Alice is sitting and sobbing in the wood is I think of this as a kind of epic story, and there's the idea in an epic of the Catabasis, which is the descent to the underworld. So the hero goes into the underworld and confronts basically their darkest fears, which is of death. And so that feeling of being lost and not being able to get back is really important, because it's actually where once you've lost everything, then you can rebuild and become a new version of yourself or whatever it is it takes to get through the last bit to get home and succeed in your adventures or your quest. And she's not really got a particular quest except to see what happens. That's Carol rejecting that traditional idea, I think. But I think that's part of the gender thing, is that the little girl can be the hero. That's why I like Alice a lot, because she sort of sticks to it. You know, and she sees her journey through and she stands up for herself.
Which is, you know, a big feature of her. She's spunky. She doesn't just kind of take... She doesn't take anything lying down. She doesn't, if she needs to defend herself or if she needs to call out something as being bullshit, she'll call it out as being bullshit.
I mean, that's partly, you know, the idea, the 19th century idea of that children should be seen and not heard, and that you don't answer back to adults. And so there's that sort of, I suspect some of the class things connect with her being able to speak back to adults, that can contradict the gardeners. You know, I mean, she is a very middle-class Victorian girl in the novel.
And there's quite a 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, American quality. Even though Catherine Beaumont is British and has a British accent, there is something indelibly American about Alice in quite a charming way in the film. In the rhythms and tempos of her as a character, the way that she speaks, the kind of wordplay that she plays with, has a very kind of crooning, poppy American quality to it.
And it would probably have to be that way if they wanted to sell the film. And I think I was thinking about that this afternoon, about when was this film came out? 1945?
1951.
So that's the kind of the height of the invention of the teenager. And you know, the post-war kind of reinvention of childhood, I think, and the child as a kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say beacon of the future, but part of that, the kind of confidence, especially in America, that kind of American sense of the American century, yeah, being sort of in command of things.
It presents her as a kind of, you know, she's self-reliant, she knows who she is, regardless of the fact that she doesn't know how to describe what's happening to her half the time because of the questions being asked of her. But she has a knowledge of herself, particularly in combat to everyone around her, which refused to give a definition of themselves. And that seems like in kind of the post-war period in America of, you know, we're trying to define what America is now. We want to know that we're self-reliant. We want our kids to have the best. We wanted them to be able to be educated and speak eloquently and have go get a drive. In a way that, like, Alice is a prototype for the American teenager of that period, the kind of ideal American teenager. She's intelligent, she's driven, and she's self-reliant.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking about the question, does Alice have a nationality? Because you remember that I mentioned that I always pictured Alice as a grown woman. And I know why, because she was voiced by a grown woman, I think, in Polish dubbing. That's why I always thought, okay, she sounds very serious, very restrained. She doesn't sound like a child, and that's why, in my mind, I have this Alice as a grown woman. And, well, as a child, and I think as a grown-up too, when the Alice came out in Poland, I'm sure a lot of people were not aware of the situation of American society or British society, Victorian society. That's why we always identify Alice as our own, right? She's a very serious Polish girl.
You know, in the English version, the voice doesn't sound like a child as well. So that's the kind of ambiguity. And she has a slightly curvaceous figure. So it's ambiguous, I think.
As much as Alice is a child, the expectations of the way she has to move through this world have to be as an adult, because everybody around her, all of these predominantly male characters, domineering characters, are talking to her as if she's an idiot, but expecting her to answer as if she's an adult. They're not none of them really ever come to Alice from the perspective of being a child. They come to her either going, I have to talk down to you because you will never be able to be as intelligent or understand everything that I'm saying. But when you respond back to me, the fact that you respond without the level of intelligence that I want you to means that I can dismiss you. So in a way, she can't, by virtue of how crazy everything is, and it's kind of the nice thing about how sturdy Alice is as a character, both in the film and in the book, that she kind of has to be, because nobody else wants to be sturdy and nobody else wants to take that responsibility and nobody wants to give her the when I think about this film, I always think about the way that grown men talk to young women, that thing of, I have to talk down to you. I have to try and meet you on what I perceive to be your level is. When you're talking to a human being who has intelligence and insight, and you don't have to do that. But that kind of way that, the way that older men talk down to young women, as I've grown up with this film, that's the thing that started to really stick with me. They did, because the characters never give her a way out. They just kind of create the Mad Hatter's Tea Party is just a series of roadblocks put in her way. She can't respond to any question with a logical answer because they don't want her to, because if she does give them a logical answer, then she'll be better than them, and that can never be the case. It's one of the really lovely things that's prevalent in the film of carrying over from the book is, yeah, it's just a bunch of men mansplaining to a child who is significantly more intelligent than they are.
And I think that comes back to that idea of taking the child seriously in terms of the novel itself. The world within it doesn't, but the novelist does and the reader does.
Yeah, and there is a contradiction, right? Because this Wonderland supposedly is ruled by a woman. We have a queen that should maybe, you know, do something about it. But no, it's actually the world still ruled by men.
It's always great seeing the inverse of what you expect from the characters of the Queen and the King of Hearts, in that the King is always presented with quite effeminate qualities. This is very binary, but with very effeminate qualities. And the Queen yells and threatens violence. She kind of approaches from a more masculine energy, which is partly what's so discombobulating about her and what's so dangerous about her. I mean, that's another aspect of this film that's very prevalent, is the continual threat of violence, whether that be within what Alice is experiencing or what Alice is being told. I mean, the Morris and the Carpenter is incredibly violent.
And also the eating may stand for a metaphor, of course, in psychoanalysis as a sex-related themes, right? So the sex and violence, still things that, usually we don't expect them to be in the work dedicated for child. But here we have both on a very subconscious level.
And Alice never participates in them. She's always kind of there to offer a commentary on the sex or the violence that exists in Wonderland. And the advantage that she has is she's too young to understand what it is, so she can kind of have an objective, logical perspective on it. One of the criticisms that's often given towards this film is the idea that it's quite cold. Why do you think that's a thing that, when the film came out, that was a criticism of it? Why do you think that people, what do you think people are referring to with saying that this film is a cold film, or that it doesn't have any heart?
That's an interesting adjective. I mean, as you were speaking before, I was just thinking about how it's a lot of Disney films are self-consciously beautiful, and Alice in Wonderland is not. There's a sort of idyllic pastoral scene on the riverbank with her sister at the beginning and at the very end, but Wonderland itself is not attractive in that way. So I'm wondering if that's part of it. But there's nothing comfortable in Wonderland either.
It's also not a safe place. It's very dangerous. So, of course, we can say, oh, I wish I would be in Wonderland. I don't want to go to the Wonderland. It's too creepy. It's too unsafe.
I mean, there's not a romantic hero to have a waltz with. And, you know, there's none of those sort of Disney traditional things we expect from Disney, you know, a little birdie.
Yeah, and it's not based on the fairy tale structure. A lot of Disney animation are based on the structure that we have a beginning of feeling the loss or so of something, then we have this adventure, the prince is coming, and we have the wedding at the end, right?
And the fact that you can feel the push and pull in the film of trying to solve the fact, because, I mean, the book doesn't have it has an episodic structure. In fact, I would probably argue in the book, Alice has even less of a motivating reason to wander through. She's just kind of wandering through it because she's just interested. The film gives her like the vaguest motivation for her adventures. But you can feel the struggle in the film of having to go, how do we make a traditional narrative film out of a book that does not have a traditional narrative structure? It's a similar kind of push and pull you can see in Peter Jackson's adaptation of The Hobbit, because The Hobbit is a very similar book. It's incredibly episodic. It doesn't have a running narrative. It doesn't have a running through line. It doesn't have a running through villain. But where a film like The Hobbit is wrestling futilely, really, in the end, of trying to turn it into something that it isn't, the really wonderful surprise of this film is they don't try and turn it into something new. And maybe that's one of the reasons why people were so discombobulated by it, was it actually doesn't try and make Alice in Wonderland into something other than what Carol intended Alice in Wonderland to be.
I was just going to say, I wonder if people were expecting their memory of reading Alice rather than the...
Yeah, exactly, yes. That's the same thing that I thought, because people have this idea of Alice being this wonderful book for children, and maybe if they read it first and then watch the animation, then maybe they will find maybe more warmth in the animation that was in the book.
I think you're completely right, Anna. Everyone has this perspective on what they think Alice is. I mean, maybe that's one of the other reasons why they're also this is the most successful, I guess, culturally and artistically, debatably, adaptation of Alice. I mean, the most, by box office, the most successful is the one made, the more recent one made, but that's barely a film to even mention. But I guess the thing is that we have an idea of what we think Alice is before we walk into the cinema, before we start watching it, and then whatever we're delivered inevitably cannot match what we think Alice is, even if we've never seen, we've never read Alice. We don't have any cultural connection to Alice other than its wider cultural footprint.
I was thinking about the recent one, which I thought was absolutely awful.
Oh, it's one of the worst films ever made. We should just get that out of the way.
It was just bad. And one of the things they did was they completely lost faith with the original. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with an adaptation playing around. But they made Alice a mature woman, top end of adolescence, and they made it an adolescent coming of age narrative rather than a child narrative where the child remains the same age the whole way through. And that was the fundamental problem with that film. But you know what? I think it responds to that comment about the coldness, because I think the fairy tale pattern as well, that idea of overcoming a literal dragon and achieving romantic success and all those sorts of things are so embedded in the sort of Disney fantasy structure that resisting that is obviously seen as cold.
But people often complain of Alice being a cold or, you know, a character without heart. Could that also be based on our perceptions of what we believe female characters should be? That we have this kind of preconceived idea about what are the qualities that a female character or a female hero or protagonist should have, and that Alice does not adhere to that preconceived idea?
Yeah, I think we might get annoyed with Alice's behavior, because just as she gets annoyed with her own world, because sometimes she doesn't behave logically even if she wants to, and that might be very frustrating for a viewer, that this world does not make any sense. And usually people look for sense in animation or in the culture in general. So that might get them disliking the movie.
Yeah, and people expect girls to be nice, don't they?
Alice is such a reactive character, and the world that she's existing in is so bizarre that we're kind of caught by looking at everything around her. You know, the risk is missing what the book gives you, which is you're actually looking at this world through her perspective, not through your perspective. So they're keeping that idea of, you know, it's the beautiful thing of, like, one of the things that's quite wonderful about the moments in the book, the caucus race. Now, we understand what the meaning of a caucus is in a political sense, but what does a caucus mean for a seven-year-old? And, you know, in that case, then it just looks like a bunch of people running around for no possible reason. So that it's kind of the risk that comes with adapting Alice to film is that because Carol so clearly gives us the lens through which we're supposed to view the world and these characters, by making a film, we become the lens. It's harder for us to connect through into Alice's eyes, particularly because we believe that a character has to have an arc, and it has to have they have to have a motivation and a challenge and a problem and all those things, none of which Alice has. And so maybe that is another problem that has happened with the film in its kind of cultural the critical responses to it, of just the difficulty of putting yourself in Alice's shoes while watching the film.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those films it's a film that resists a comfortable reading, so and that's what makes great art, is when there is that kind of resistance and you have to do a bit of thinking through.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people might not feel very comfortable watching this movie because it challenges you as a viewer, but as a person as well, to question the reality around you. And for a very long time, Alice in Wonderland does not give us a consolation or any kind of advice, because even Alice has no advice for herself. And the best thing that the most comforting thing from this movie is, okay, don't worry, it's just a dream, you will wake up.
The other thing is that, like, Alice, when you look at a child and they look back at you, what are they seeing? And I think there's something quite uncomfortable if we know what a child is actually thinking. I mean, I went to the supermarket this afternoon and I was getting in the car. I couldn't get it started quickly, and there was this little boy eating an ice cream watching me, and I felt like a complete fool as I tried to get my car into reverse. And I think that the idea of the child looking back is discomforting for people.
What we get with Alice is what the child might be seeing. What you know, the what we think of in our behavior as adults is logical. Like the Tea Party. For the Mad Hatter and the March Hare, this all seems completely logical. Going back to what we're talking about how there's so much domesticity in the story, and in particular in the film, the way that Alice is entering into a situation where there is a domestic chore to be completed or a domestic ritual to be completed, she has, you know, in the way that a child has, a really clear idea about this happens, then this happens. Like a very beautiful clarity. What she sees are adults riffing on those ideas or adding all these extra things and adding these extra complications that don't make sense with the domestic task that's being presented to them. She just wants to sit and have a cup of tea. They're making it significantly worse. And they just look at her and go, what do you mean? This is the way we're supposed to do this. In a way, I think you're right. It is kind of the beautiful, disquieting quality of it is we know that that's what we're being presented with. Alice is a child's view of how stupid the adult world is. And she's a character that can kind of sit there and be like, and the adult world is kind of dumb.
Oh, read the directions. And directly you'll be directed in the right direction.
Drink me. Better look first. For if one drinks much from a bottle marked poison, it's almost certain to disagree with one sooner or later.
Beg your pardon?
I was just giving myself some good advice.
Despite now having an aesthetic direction, Alice in Wonderland was still in trouble, and both Walt and the staff were growing tired of the film. Roy openly hated the project, and he and Walt had even tried to bump the film in the schedule in favour for Peter Pan, but that film was nowhere near ready either. For so many years, though, Walt had been told constantly by those outside the studio that the property was perfect for them, and so they persevered, less out of enthusiasm than obligation. The story still proved impossible to crack, despite the involvement of 13 writers, including Joe Grant and Dick Humer, on their last project together. In an effort to capture the musicality of Carol's writing, it was decided that music would drive the story, but this didn't make things easier. Frank Churchill had started composing songs in 1939, but none of them were used in the final film. And after their success on Cinderella, the songwriting team of Mac David, Al Hoffman, and Jerry Livingston were brought on, but the only song of theirs used was the Unbirthday song. In the end, 9 songwriters were credited for the 14 songs in the film. More songs than in any other Disney animated feature. Foreseeing potential problems at the box office, Walt enlisted an impressive voice cast for the film, including popular comics Ed Wynn, Jerry Colonna, Sterling Holloway, Bill Thompson, Verna Felton, and J. Pat O'Malley. For Alice, he chose 10-year-old British actor Catherine Beaumont, who became the first actor placed under contract by the studio. As with Cinderella, the entire film was shot as live-action reference. But during the filming of the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, Ed Wynn, who played the Mad Hatter, and Jerry Colonna, who played the March Hare, delivered such energetic and immediate performances that the raw vocal tracks for the scene were used, instead of the clean vocal tracks recorded later.
Mustard, yes, but mustard! Don't let's be silly!
Walt was more insistent than ever that the animators stick as closely as possible to Mary Blair's concept art, which only added to their frustrations with the story and having to adhere to the live-action reference. No one had solved the issue of the story's episodic nature, so each of the sequence directors approached each scene as a separate entity, and were so determined to outdo one another that the film was developing, as Walt put it, the tempo of a 3-ring circus. They were letting their imaginations run wild in a desperate attempt to connect with the project. But Walt always insisted on returning to the novel, even rejecting some of Ward Kimball's ideas as being too weird. In order to keep up with the demands of the film, the Colour Lab were forced to increase their staff, and the colour model department, in charge of developing new paint colours for the studio, explored twice as many colour options than was standard for a Disney feature. As the film throttled towards its release in July 1951, the collective patience for the project had almost dried up. And yet, something special was happening. Where later adaptations of the Alice books would handle their cinematic limitations by drawing outside of the lines, Walt's insistence that they stick as close to the book as possible meant that they were achieving something no one had done before or since. Other films had and would simply put Lewis Carroll's story on the screen. Walt Disney Productions were actually bringing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland to life. Before I ask my last question on the film itself, I just want to also ask, what are the other film versions that you've seen of Alice, and where does this sit in relation to those other film versions for you?
Well, I've seen the Frank Meyer, which I think I saw when I was about 18 at a film festival, and I was kind of shocked and stunned by it. For listeners, it uses a lot of taxidermied animals, and there's lots of bird skulls and things like that, and it's quite super creepy, I think it's probably the right word. and so I think it was a huge shock for me seeing that. And then I've seen Tim Burton who did the recent one, which I didn't like very much, as you know. I don't know that I've seen any others. I saw the Australian Ballet version, which was interesting because it brought back the love story, but it made it between Alice and, what's his name, Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, I've seen, I think, all the Disney adaptations, so Tim Burton's as well. Didn't like it at all.
I'm glad we're all in agreement on that. I'm glad we're all in agreement that is a bad film.
Very, very bad. But I also seen, I think, the beginning of the TV series Once Upon a Time in Wonderland. It's also produced by Disney, and I think there Alice was in a mental hospital or mental institution. So that's one of the tropes that repeats, I think, in many adaptations, that Alice is not very healthy.
That's such a lazy trope to apply to Alice. It kind of implies a refusal to engage with the ideas in the book, the refusal to go, well, okay, well, the world is weird and everything's very surreal and nothing makes any sense. The assumption of, oh, well, then it must be a flaw in Alice, or it's actually a comment on something else. I just always find that trope so frustrating.
So I've noticed that with each and every adaptation, Alice can get darker and darker, which shows the potential of the original. And for example, I remember I've played the video game American McGee's Alice. So creepy, and I loved it. And this was one of my favorite adaptation. Very murderous, crazy world of a teenager. Oh, that has this blue apron, a blue dress and white apron, so we know that this is almost Disney Alice, but not quite. And I love the illustrations for the Alice in Wonderland by, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce it correctly, Tove Jansson, the author of The Lumines. I think they're so wonderful. I know it's not an adaptation, but, well, it kind of is.
Where do we find Alice at the end of this film? Like, what... Is Alice the same at the end of this film as she was at the beginning of this film? And how has she changed?
I don't know. I'm really torn in Alice between the idea of the child that doesn't change and the child outside of time, and then the allure of time and passing through time and having that journey where you go, down and up again into maybe the recesses of the mind or the underworld or the wonderland or whatever it is. And maybe that's what it is for me. It's that tension between those different types of storytelling. And then the question is about meaning and identity and maybe survival as well. And that Alice goes to a place where there is no meaning. And then she has to return back to a place where there is meaning. And I actually was wondering what both of you thought about the story, what her sister was reading on the bank,
which is what the mouse reads the story that the long tail the mouse says in the book.
And it's sort of this sort of long, pointless, rambling history about different kings who did different things. If that's adulthood, do you want, is that what you want? And I think in the book, when she goes back to tea, she sort of, I think she says, what a curious adventure I've had, or something like that. So she actually goes back in the book with a sense of her adventures in her, as opposed to, I think in the film, it's like she just leaves them.
I think what Alice's experiences at the beginning is the world of literature, the world of words. And then she goes to the world of images. And at the end, she integrates both. I think so, because she comes back and she's not as uncomfortable with her sister reading her book as she was at the beginning. So she experienced both. Both were terrible apart, but together they're okay. And I think that might be another key for interpretation.
That's a brilliant interpretation. I'm like, that's fabulous. I hadn't even considered that as an idea.
Yeah, I think it can be, again, very therapeutic for both children and adults. And we have both book by Carol, words, and Disney animation pictures, and they both work very well. I think they're not exclude each other. No, yeah.
And they're beautifully in conversation with one another, I think. I think there is definitely a feeling the best adaptations, you know, something like Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women, you get the sense this is a work that's in conversation with the source, with its source material. It's not simply putting it up on the screen. It's asking it questions. It's playing around with it. It's riffing with it. But the link is there. And in a way that I think that's why this is my favorite adaptation of Alice, because I love the fact that I can see and feel the link between the two works.
Your Majesty, members of the jury, loyal subjects, and the King.
Roy and Walt were cautious about the box office prospects for Alice in Wonderland and explored new ways to promote the film. Television networks had approached Walt a number of times for a television special, and he decided that he might be able to use the medium to the film's advantage. On Christmas Day 1950, NBC aired 1 Hour in Wonderland, a television broadcast sponsored by the Coca-Cola Company and hosted by Walt, featuring Catherine Beaumont and other celebrities, along with clips from classic Disney films, alongside a glimpse of Alice. They also tried to bank on the popularity of the cast, featuring their names on the poster, the first time a voice cast of a Disney animated film had featured in the advertising. After nearly 50,000 man-hours to produce nearly 700,000 drawings at the cost of $3 million, Alice in Wonderland premiered at Leicester Square in London on July 26, 1951. The response from critics in the UK was swift and scathing. "This million-pound ineptitude deserves nothing but boos," wrote William Whitebait in New Statesman, "and I wish cinema audiences were in the habit of according them." They criticised what they saw as an Americanisation of Carol's books and found the film lacking in heart. Critics in the US weren't much more forgiving. Time wrote on August 6, 1951 that, "Judged simply as the latest in the long, popular line of Disney cartoons, Alice lacks a developed storyline, which the studio's continuity experts, for all their freedom with scissors and paste, have been unable to put together out of the episodic books." Walt wasn't overly surprised. He had anticipated the criticism, especially from literary circles, and in many cases, he agreed with them. He also found the film lacking in warmth, especially Alice herself, and was unhappy with its erratic tone. Unfortunately, the public shared his lack of enthusiasm. The film did poorly at the box office, unable to repeat the success of Cinderella, and ended up losing nearly $1 million on its initial domestic run. It was nominated for an Oscar for Oliver Wallace's score, but lost to An American in Paris. It was also embroiled in a legal battle between Walt Disney Productions and a French-British co-production produced by Lou Boonen. Anticipating competition, Disney sought an injunction to prevent the competing film from being released in the US, while the Boonen production accused Disney of exploiting their film by releasing the Disney film at the same time. In the end, the case was thrown out, though the Boonen production faced further challenges when theatre chains favoured the Disney film over theirs, and they were denied access to Technicolor for prints. The film was never re-released during Walt's lifetime, though in 1954 began to appear in an edited version on television. In the 1970s, though, it started to gain a cult following on college campuses, with the studio finally re-releasing the film in 1974 as a double bill with Fantasia, promoting its psychedelic qualities. They even paired it with Jefferson Airplane's song White Rabbit. Over the following decades, it would gain in popularity and stature, and is now one of the most beloved Disney animated features. Perhaps the most extraordinary aspect of Alice in Wonderland, though, is how the frustrations of its development and production resulted in perhaps the most faithful screen adaptation of Lewis Carroll's novel. Sticking to the source material had forced them to listen to it, not to the mechanics of the story, but to its tone, wit, and musicality. There are certainly more literal adaptations of the book, but where others suffer in their fidelity, or worse, ignore the voice of the novel altogether, the 1951 Alice in Wonderland captures its spirit, keying into Carroll's rhythms, wit, and wordplay, and visually responding to them. There's a lot they invented, like the talking doorknob and the Hall of Doors, but it all feels like it could have come from Carroll, imbued with his imagination and sense of humour. Even their adherence to the episodic structure is a revelation. Rather than applying an arbitrary framing device or inventing a motivation for Alice, they couldn't conceive of any other option than preserving that structure, and as a result, allow Alice to be the same determined, driven, and no-nonsense character as on the page. In 1951, Walt Disney and the many hundreds of artists involved in Alice in Wonderland assumed they had failed in their efforts to bring Lewis Carroll's masterpiece to the screen. In fact, they had succeeded in ways they couldn't yet comprehend. More so than anyone before or since, they had captured the book's lightning-in-a-bottle magic and irreverence, and in the process, delivered a masterpiece of their own. Well, to finish up with my last question that I ask on Ink and Paint, it's a big question and I often get a lot of angry noises when I ask it. For each of you, what is your favourite Disney animated classic?
I think for me it's actually Sleeping Beauty, because I think that's the first one I really remember seeing and loving. I wasn't cross with it for being different from the original, as I there's something just very, and I had a jigsaw puzzle from Sleeping Beauty when I was little, of the Prince Charming and fighting Maleficent. So it just takes me back to my kind of cozy childhood storytelling space, I think. But I love the stories. I love the songs in Sleeping Beauty, and I love the bit where they waltzed in the forest and the her dress kept changing colour as a little girl. That was just, oh, that was my dream come true. You know, I just wanted that dress so much.
I can say which animation was my favourite when I was a child, because now it's very, very difficult to answer, but I was obsessed with Pocahontas because I loved animals. She had a lot of animals in her wood. Very, very simple reasons, but she was so free and she was running through these woods and she felt this connection to nature. And she was talking to a tree and it was normal. And yeah, I think she was a very, very free-spirited woman who was very brave. But yeah, then she had this John Smith.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being my guest on this episode. The big episode. This is one I've been looking forward to for a long time. I was a little bit worried I wouldn't be particularly objective with it, but we had a fabulous conversation with the two of you. Thank you so much for giving me your time and your insight into this terrific film and this amazing book.
Thank you for the workout.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
After the burst of energy from Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland had dampened the enthusiasm of the artists at Walt Disney Productions, and especially Walt himself. In fact, Walt wasn't even in the country when Alice opened in the US. He was in Europe with his family, overseeing their latest live-action film, The Adventures of Robin Hood and His Merry Men. He barely attended story meetings anymore, was far less emotionally invested in the animated projects, and was becoming even more distant from the Burbank lot. Instead, he had become fixated on a new idea, his most ambitious yet, one that would once again send shockwaves through American culture. In the meantime, the animation staff were hard at work on another adaptation of a literary classic, one almost as beloved as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It would allow the artists at Walt Disney Productions to stretch their wings and shake off their frustrations, with a story of a boy with his head in the clouds and a determination to never grow up. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
There's quite a theme running through both the book and the film about what is a mother, and Wendy at some point is actually declared, I think, by Peter Pan to be the mother.
I'm joined by social historian Frank Golding to talk about the marvellous and melancholy adventures of Peter Pan. Thanks again to Dr. Elizabeth Hale and to Anna Mick for joining me on this episode. You can find out more about the Our Mythical Childhood Project at www.omc.obta.al.uw.edu.pl. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the making of Alice in Wonderland, including concept art and animation sketches, and information about the history of the film on home video. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Hit us up with your comments, questions, or even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on upcoming episodes. We're also starting work on a series of in-betweeners on the creation of Disneyland. So if you have any memories of your visits to the happiest place on Earth, we'd love to include them in the episode. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. You can also follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Ink Paint Pod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. We release new episodes of Ink and Paint every fortnight, as well as bonus in-betweeners every now and then. So if you enjoy the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform. And don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Pirinakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.